Hello, everybody. Welcome to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a different type of a program. You're used to me introducing scientists, engineers, who have sort of got a niche in some form of research that's sort of pushing forward the bounds of scientific research. But today we're going to be talking to a gentleman. His name is Bill Hartman. He's the president and CEO of a company called Premier Biomedical Inc. that's sort of forging a relationship between the Department of Defense, largely out here in Fort Bliss in West Texas, the University of Texas at El Paso, and his own company with people who invest in his company to try to look into the future of treatment of all sorts of different diseases with revolutionary new treatments, but where, in fact, we're pushing the boundaries not only of science, but also collaboration between universities and private business. Bill Hartman, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here. What I'm going to describe today is really going to test the future. And my statement is very bold, but believe me, I believe it with every intensity of my being. And that is, this technology and this company will revolutionize medicine. I'll state that again emphatically. This company and this technology will revolutionize medicine as we know it.
That is a profoundly intensive opening gambit. I used to play a lot of chess, and this is a really good opening gambit that most people won't know how to deal with. But before we get on to this sort of new technology and the opportunities that it provides, let's let the audience know a little bit about Bill Hartman. How did you – you're an engineer by training, that much I know, and here you are now sort of running a company that's going to revolutionize medicine. Tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, Keith, I first became interested in science and becoming an engineer in 1957. I was in high school at the time, Hubbard High School in Hubbard, Ohio, and the Russians put up the Sputnik. And I remember reading that the paper said that scientists and engineers would be in great demand in the future. And we were studying in school, of course, the laws of supply and demand. And I knew that if there was a restricted supply and a huge demand, that meant you'd make more money. And that was my goal at that time in my life, that I wanted to make more money and improve my standard of living. So I was going to be an engineer and a scientist.
That's very interesting, Bill, because I was the same age as you. And when Sputnik came, beep, 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 all over London every 24 hours or whatever. Right. And I remember the whole school, we were taken out into the playground when it was going to be overhead. I don't know if I ever saw anything, but the bottom line was it was being broadcast, the beep, 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 beep. And right. It made a profound impact. You know, it sort of shook the West out of its sort of complacency about right. being the technologically advanced group. And it certainly stimulated a phenomenal number of guests that have been on Science Studio, the number of people who have started their conversation, just as you did. I remember Sputnik, and that was the driving force, because America changed right there and really pushed for science and engineering. But you had that extra twist, supply, demand, income. Yes. I like that.
Yep. Well, I graduated from high school and went to a local university, Youngstown State University. At that time, it was Youngstown University. Worked as hard as I could, and when I graduated, I didn't even own a suit to take any interviews. But between January of 1964 and June of 1964, when I physically graduated, I began interviewing in early January. And I interviewed extremely well. I was a 3-3, not a 4-0 student, but I worked two jobs to get through school. And interestingly enough, the offers started coming, and the placement people at the university said that I was their number one guy. And when people came into town and wanted to talk to the number one guy, I was picked. And lo and behold, I ended up with 32 offers
from the largest corporations in the world. And you intensely by your fellow students. Hartman come to the interview.
Yeah. I was intensely disliked, but, you know, from jealousy reasons, et cetera. Right. But I had 32 offers, and interestingly enough, I picked Ford Motor Company because I liked cars and I liked Fords, and Ford had a training program, rotational assignment thing, and frankly, I picked them, and I started work for Ford Motor Company in 1964 as an engineer trainee, and I progressed through the company, stayed some 20 years, And at the end of that period of time, frankly, some of the most profound things in my life happened at that time, because in large companies, sometimes you can get stratified. You literally can't see the whole world. I was offered an opportunity to become chief engineer at TRW, an automotive supplier. Ford had not had a bonus in 5 years, and the bonus was a big part of my income. So I bit the bullet and said I was going to go to TRW Automotive. That's Thompson Ramo Wooldridge, a big supplier, automotive supplier.
And Ford didn't make a counteroffer? Because that's usually the
No,
the
I left. Okay. In fact, Ford was on the death throes at that time in 1984, and I went to TRW as chief engineer. And, of course, my whole horizon broadened. I was a chief product development engineer. Well, I soon said, wait a minute. You know, I not only have to figure out what to make, I have to figure out how to make it and make it profitable. It just made sense to me. So I absorbed that added responsibility of chief process engineer. And now we put everything all in one. And then after we developed several tremendous ideas and prospects for business, my management would say to me, yeah, but you don't have a purchase order. So I expanded myself, and I went out and I sold the idea. So I not only had to develop the idea and the process, how to make it, but also how to sell it. And I became the chief salesman.
That was the melting pot that sort of developed your career. And that's what you're still doing now. You're organizing. Yep. You're finding some useful niche, except it's in the biomedical arena. Tell us how that transition from Ford Motor Car, automotive supply, into medicine. There was an important story there.
Well, yeah. What happened, and I had shared this with Keith earlier, I retired from the auto industry when they made it beneficial to me. They bought me out, literally. I got a 2-year separation. And interestingly enough, my wife was suffering from a neurologic disease that got progressively worse. They thought that it was the onset, because she had her first seizure at the age of 14. They thought it was the onset of pubescent epilepsy. And they gave her anti-seizure medications, and she functioned for a while, but then progressively over the years got worse and worse, and to the point where a startle reflex was so strong that she would shake and stand bolt upright still and shake. Her whole body would tremble, and within a few seconds she'd fall over backwards, stiff as a board, broke some 7 bones, and we thought it was going to kill her, so we put her in a wheelchair.
Just in response to outside influences?
Outside influences. A startle, a phone rings, a call her name, okay. A telephone rings, a doorbell rings, a noise on television. So, frankly, we were beside ourselves. No one. I had her to every hospital in 4 states, and nobody could tell me even what she had nor how to cure it. And finally, in desperation, we had had her in Florida for 6 weeks in a hospital, and nobody there could find out what she had. They deprived her of every medication she'd been on for years. And I was desperate, and I just picked eeny, meeny, miny, moe. I picked someone out of the phone book, and it was Dr. Felder, Mitchell Felder in Sharon, Pennsylvania. And I took him there, and he not only correctly diagnosed it in time, but correctly treated it. And today she's as normal as you and I. So I owe Dr. Felder a vote of dedication and thanks.
And because of you meeting him, then you realized that he himself had an entrepreneur sort of characteristic to his career.
Right. He had patents on the wall. And
you don't go to many doctor's offices and see patents.
Yeah. You don't see patents in doctor's offices. And it basically dealt with the detection of bacterial diseases. And he had some 30 patents. I'm inventive genius. Man is an inventive genius. And I asked him, I said, are you in a business of some kind? And he wasn't very forthcoming. But finally, I got it out of him. And when he asked me, I asked him aspects of his business. And when he explained how he was doing some aspect, I'd say, wrong. You should do it this way, not that way. And he looked at me puzzled, like, who are you to tell me how to run business? Well, long story short, we worked together, and he gave me a position in his small company. And I did it just to keep out of boredom. But I completely had to re-engineer myself to learn a whole new vernacular, a whole new vocabulary, a whole new approach to business. But I loved it. I loved being challenged. I loved the fact that I could reinvent myself. The auto industry, of course, was suffering. I was able to reinvent myself. And a situation came up where he lost control of the company through a hostile takeover. And he left, and then I left. And about 2 years later, he called me up and said, how'd you like to go back into business? Because he felt that we'd been a good match. And I said, fine, only this time I want to call the shots on the business. You do the technical and I'll do the business. And that's how we formed Premier Biomedical.
I mean, it's a very interesting story because serendipity, you know, you picked on this fellow just from the Yellow Pages,
yep.
Right, effectively.
But what it says, Keith, is beyond that. It says that young people today that are graduating and the job situation isn't like it was when you and I graduated from undergrad. You know, I challenge these young people to say this. Look, be willing to work. Be willing to apply yourself. Give the very most that you have. Approach your job with the passion of it's your company. It's even if you're just working for someone, do the job to the very best of your ability and be willing to reinvent yourself. There is plenty of opportunity out there today for those who are willing to be passionate and to go after their job with the intensity that's required to make the business succeed. And I've been able to successfully reinvent myself several times. And I'm not bragging. It's just me.
It's a fact.
That's the way I am.
Right. Let's talk then about Premier Biomedical. What is your focus? Who are your partners?
Premier Biomedical's basic strategy, and we trademark this saying, we conquer disease, whether it's neurologic diseases and/or bloodborne diseases. We've identified some 19. Diseases to date that we can attack using this philosophy, and that is the physical removal of the pathophysiologic basis of the disease. Keith, God made this body in a miraculous way that it fights off diseases until such time as they're overwhelmed. The body, the immune system gets overwhelmed. We physically remove those pathophysiologic bases of disease and allow the body to heal itself in the future. And we've been enormously successful in experimentation to date.
So by this, you mean a sort of a sophisticated form of dialysis. I mean, basically, you're passing the blood
right.
Just as they do in regular dialysis laboratories and facilities. But you've got a special sort of target.
Yeah. Now, physically, neurologic diseases, that would be basically we extract the body fluids. In this case, in neurologic diseases, we extract cerebral spinal fluid, and we physically remove those molecular compounds. Now, it's extremely difficult because the larger ones are picogram. That's a trillionth of a gram. Now, in their natural state, they cannot be removed because they're too small. You can't filter them. You can't centrifuge them. How do you remove them? Well, basically, we do this outside the body by injecting antibodies to the antigens that are within the body that cause the disease and harm. And basically, in the combined state, we can dialyze these out. And there are some, even yesterday, we were talking some that are much tinier than, for example, glutamate. In the body, when a person has a concussion, they have 140 times as much glutamate in the cerebrospinal fluid as a normal person. So, how do you remove the glutamate? Well, that was the subject of an experiment we're doing with the Army and with the University of Texas.
And we'll come back to that after we've taken a short break. This is Keith Pannell talking with Bill Hartman from Premier Biomedical Incorporated. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Just how much of the Y chromosome is needed to make a male?
Not much, at least according to a new study. And here, I thought I was way more complex.
Norbert, you've always been your greatest fan.
Ha! We had known for a couple of decades that only one gene determines sex. Now we also know that it takes just two genes out of the 78 genes on the Y chromosome to actually produce a healthy male. Well, for now, male mice.
But that has huge implications for humans and male infertility. It could mean that men with immature sperm could reproduce through in vitro fertilization. In the study, researchers tried exactly that.
They injected immature mouse sperm into mouse eggs. This immature sperm contained two genes on the Y chromosome, the SRY gene, which determines sex, and the EIF2S3Y, which produces sperm cell precursors.
In 9% of cases, these offspring grew into normal, healthy male mice that were infertile but could reproduce with help. Even though that's well below the 26% success rate when they injected eggs with a Y chromosome, it's still eye-opening.
To try this on humans, scientists would need to tweak the method since EIF2S3Y is not on the Y chromosome. Instead, there's a copy on the X chromosome.
It's possible by using EIF2S3Y, one day researchers can develop precursor sperm cells that mature enough to produce viable offspring. These male children would also have immature sperm cells and need help reproducing.
This study doesn't render the rest of the Y chromosome useless. In fact, those genes are necessary in producing fully viable sperm capable of fertilization.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Bill Hartman from Premier Biomedical, talking about a really adventurous collaboration that it turns out is with the University of Texas at El Paso, the Department of Defense out here at Fort Bliss and other locations, about trying to find a way to preempt a lot of disease by removing nasty pathogenic materials from our blood, spinal fluids, etc. Tell us, who are the collaborators? Because obviously you're the business brain. You're the person that's sort of setting up. You're the one who goes out to get the funding to for the startup company, essentially, that this is Biomedical Inc. But who are the technical people? Who and where does the Army come into this?
Okay. Keith, when we started the company, of course, you know, I'm not the scientist. Dr. Felder is. And Dr. Felder said, we need an oncologist, we need a nephrologist, and every kind of ogist that frankly, I can't even pronounce or understand what they do. And I said, how much would these people cost us? Well, $100,000 each. And it just seemed to me to be disjointed, and we end up with nothing. We end up with a bunch of disjointed people doing disjointed tasks. And I said, that doesn't make any sense. Let's go to someone that has all the capabilities. And I said, let's try the Army. And Dr. Felder was on staff at the Army. He's a contract physician, a board-certified neurologist at the William Beaumont Army Medical Center here at Fort Bliss. And we approached management there. And in my naivete, I said, why don't we work together? Well, I didn't know there was a formal program called a CRADA, a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, as the acronym CRADA. And I proposed it to them, and they thought about it and thought about it. And that was literally August 2nd of 2010. And they vetted us for a full 3 years. And finally, within the last 6 months of that three-year period or so, they said, look, you're just not far enough along. You have all theory. We need practical proof. So I said, well, how do we get that practical proof? Well, the only way we could do it is go to the University of Texas at El Paso. And we approached them with the philosophy of, why don't we work together? And here's with a non-disclosure agreement, here's our technology. And they rolled their eyes and said, a lot of people have tried this and not succeeded. So they tried it, and they came back in about 3 months and said, oh, my goodness, we've been successful in doing exactly what you said, and removing various molecular compounds of the picogram size.
You mean the researchers here at UTEP?
The researchers here at UTEP.
Under the guidance of
Dr. Kirkin,
right.
Who's now Dean of Science. I said, well, that's fine. And only this time around, what I want to make you a partner. I don't want to just hire you for R&D, because I want the university to have some skin in the game. So basically, they're a partner in this. They're not just a gun for hire. So they didn't know how to handle that. No one's ever offered them part of a company before. And it took about 3 months of negotiation and contracts, and they've become a 10% of profits partner to Premier Biomedical.
But Premier Biomedical is actually, it's on the stock market. So does that mean that we as the university have stock in this operation?
Well, the university does have stock in the Premier Biomedical in terms of by contract, when the company sold and or any profits made, you have 10%. But are they individual stockholders? I have no knowledge of that. And frankly, that's not important. The important thing is they're a 10% partner by definition and by contract. And the relationship has been enormously successful. We consummated the relationship in May of 2012. It's now May of 2014. And what we've achieved in 2 years, we have technology meetings with the DOD and with UTEP people every month. And I come in from Pennsylvania, which is where our business offices are located. And we've now headquartered ourselves in El Paso. And what do I see in the future? Well, what I see in the future is this relationship between the Army, the DOD, and ourselves, and the University of Texas. We were constantly in the past, we were in the middle. The Army would come to us when they wanted something from UTEP, and UTEP would come to us when they wanted something from the Army. And that really wasn't functioning as well as it should have. So right now, though, the three partners are talking to each other. And UTEP and the Army are working together, and they're working with us. And I just had a meeting yesterday, and it was enormously successful. We're now taking off on projects on Alzheimer's disease, on MS, and traumatic brain injury, and breast cancer.
So this is sort of, I think, interesting to the listener, because all of a sudden you find that the Army, the Department of Defense, is taking this major role in the healthcare of the country. Now, it had a particular stimulus because that's a very open-ended project. I mean, You know, the National Institutes of Health is supposed to be looking after the health of the nation. And now the Army is coming along with its own budget. Tell us how that began, because it was a very specific sort of impetus.
Well, frankly, the Army had an enormous problem of soldiers committing suicide. And this is not my data, but the data from the Veterans Administration. Frankly, as a result of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI, traumatic brain injury, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, the Army is experiencing one suicide per day from active duty personnel. And if you count veterans, and Keith, this is frankly a shameful number. It is literally one every hour.
Actual suicides.
24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You're having that many suicides. And when a person commits suicide, all of his beneficiaries, suddenly all their benefits are cut off. So they have to be pretty desperate. So we believe that we had the technology to extract from cerebral spinal fluid, the molecular compounds that are formed in the brain when a person has a traumatic brain injury or PTSD, whatever. And we've demonstrated that in the laboratory at UTEP.
And you've demonstrated that particular ingredient should remain ingredient X. If you remove it, then that in theory is lessening the probabilities of suicide. I mean,
that's the
gambit that you have there.
Yeah.
Now, that's not proven, surely.
Now,
I mean, you can't do rat suicide studies.
Now, what we're doing, in fact, this was just resolved, in fact, yesterday, last night, in a very lengthy meeting we had here at UTEP with the Army, and that is we've successfully demonstrated that we've extracted these two molecular compounds, not one. But then the question remains, well, what about the follow-up? Are the soldiers healed? In fact, are they better? In fact, are their depression symptoms lessened? So what we've agreed to do is to move towards clinical trials, staged clinical trials, where they're identifying a sampling of soldiers that are in fact suicidal and or clinically depressed, and we're going to then extract the cerebrospinal fluid, extract these molecular compounds, and then put it back into the soldier, and then follow up on whether or not the soldier has been in fact healed. Now, it's not only soldiers, but NFL, NHL, basketball, et cetera, the sports figures, NASCAR, these people are
even
suffering.
Even soccer. But
soccer,
that's a very big advance, if I could say the advance in terms of a step forward, that the military has this capacity then to have volunteers I mean, to do clinical studies is usually a very complicated, time-consuming operation. But because of the Army and the nature of the Army, then this is a lot more facile?
Yes. Yes, Keith. Frankly, as a small company or even as a large company, because of the research we've done in cancer and other things where we've had press releases, I get emails constantly from people, their wives, their children, their husbands, somebody suffering terribly in disease, and they've been diagnosed as terminal. And they're desperate, so they send me emails or call me on the phone. And I'll say to them, look, we're not ready for clinical trials yet, but here's the problem. When you administer anything marked experimental, even though these people are desperate and they'll sign the papers, chances are if they ever have any imagined symptoms as a result of the experimental treatment you've given them, they're probably going to sue you. And that is a huge risk for any company, whatever their size. So the Army has the capability of running these tests. And they volunteered that. I did not extract that from them as a promise, but their expertise is testing of large animals and doing clinical trials. That means actual testing on humans. So they certainly have a lot of people suffering from
these. So when you join the Army, then in a sense, if you're automatically going to be enrolled in these research protocols?
No, Keith. This would be strictly on a voluntary basis. Yeah. They'd obviously have to sign releases, et cetera. But what it says about the Army and this effort is that the Army is trying and reaching out in all areas to develop these cures for these diseases, because they have an obligation. These people contracted many of these illnesses as a result of service to this country.
Absolutely.
So we as a people, we have an obligation to give them the very best that science can develop, and we believe that that's the treatment from Premier Biomedical.
And just to finish this off, because this is a program from the University of Texas at El Paso, the basic scientific research then is being done here on the campus, and maybe also at William Beaumont, I don't know that, but using graduate students, postdoctoral, undergraduate researchers and faculty. So this is really a very big departure for the institution.
Not totally. The University of Texas, you know, proper, not only UTEP, but University of Texas proper, and all universities do research for hire. But to my knowledge, this is one of the first situations where they have become a partner in the business. Now, Keith mentioned the odd relationship of the Army and academia. Well, frankly, I don't find that odd at all. It just makes a lot of sense to me, because an awful lot of brain power resides within academia, mm-hmm. and certainly within the Army. And why don't we harness that and pull it together? Yes, we've had issues we've had to resolve. We've had issues of turf. Who owns it? Why do you own it? How do you own it? And why? And just recently, we completed a very successful mouse study on breast cancer. I mean, stunning results, where we not only healed cancer in mice using Premier's technology, but then the mice were immune to subsequent injections of breast cancer, which means we successfully manipulated the immune system. So really working all of these sources of brain power together makes a lot of sense.
And I'd like to thank you for what you're doing on behalf of the university, on behalf of the military, on behalf of your stockholders.
Humanity.
That's a big one. I don't tend to speak for humanity. It's a bit too big for me. But on behalf of humanity, Bill Hartman from Premier Biomedical Inc., thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
Well, thank you for having me, Keith. I feel passionate about this business, and I feel passionate about what you're doing in NPR. And very frankly, I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Norman Martinez, for putting it together. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech's Paul L. Foster School of Medicine in El Paso now has a Willed Body program. People who donate their bodies help to advance medical research and help train future doctors. The program is open to anyone 18 and older. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Sierra Providence Health Network.